Hello? Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is Mauricio Ordonez. I'm the program manager lead for SharePoint Workflow. And with me, there's Tim McConnell, who's a program manager on my team. And we're very excited to be here to talk to you about SharePoint Workflow. What we're going to talk about today is, there's quite a lot of good information, both in our documentation and out on the web, on how to write workflows in SharePoint. And so, given that you've made the trip all the way out to Redmond, what I thought I'd do today is to actually focus on taking a peek under the hood of the workflow engine itself. Rather than focusing on how you build solutions on the engine, we want to give you a view into how the engine itself works, with the goal that a better understanding of the engine will help you use the protocols in order to interoperate with it. So I'm going to start off by first just I'm going to lay out a few basic concepts, and then we're going to build from that. So starting off, when we talk about workflow, the term itself means many different things. It can be used in many different contexts. And at a high level, when we think about workflow, we think just the way people work together. But for this conversation, when we use the word workflow, we're going to mean specifically two things. We're going to talk about automated business processes and also a programming model in SharePoint for building workflow solutions. And that programming model is one that is designed around a paradigm of the process itself being long-running, being event-driven, and also being episodic in nature. By episodic, it means that it will do work in bursts as a result of some event, and then when it reaches an idle point, the workflow itself will persist to disk, it will be evicted from memory, and then when it has additional work to do, it will rehydrate and it will resume. And that's the workflow programming model. So SharePoint workflows are focused on document-centric, human-centric types of processes, there are other in workflow scenarios, you can think of everything all the way from straight-through processing. Sometimes it's thought of as workflow, but that's really not the focus of SharePoint workflow. SharePoint workflows are really focused around being content-centric, which is the strength of SharePoint. So think about out of the box, we ship a few workflow solutions that we built on the platform that we're going to go into today, and those are things like approval, collecting digital signatures, and feedback. Okay, so then building on, let's talk about a few of the core concepts that we'll see over and over, and you'll see this also in the protocol documentation as well. So there are three core entities in workflow. There's the template, which is also another word for the workflow definition. Think of this as the program. There's the association, which is something that binds that program into a specific SharePoint context. And lastly, it's the instance, which is a running instance of that program. And then the workflows, so essentially in this diagram, we have the workflow template, which as I said is the program definition. And through an association, it gets related to a SharePoint content type. It can also be bound to a list. And also to a SharePoint site. And it's a one-to-many relationship between the template and the entity in SharePoint, such as the list. And so, for instance, in here we can see that we have one workflow template which can be bound to a list as an expense approval association, or it can also be bound in a different context as a spec approval association. And then what a user actually will create when they create an instance, they're actually creating an instance of that association. So the association brings to the instance some additional contextual information, which is available at runtime for the instance. And so the instance itself is bound to a particular content point inside of SharePoint. Okay. So this is basically recapping some of the information that I had on that slide. So in order to first make the workflow available to be able to run, the first thing you need to do is associate it. So you publish, the user will publish a workflow, then they'll create an association, and then at that point the workflow is ready to run. And it can be run as a result of a manual start operation where the user in the UI says, start this workflow, or it can also be run as a result of an event that happens, such as a document gets put on a list, or there's a change in a list item. All of those are different triggers that can initiate a workflow. Then when the workflow is running, it will modify the list view to show status information. And there's a status column that is displayed for every association of the workflow. And then when an instance is running in the UI, you'll see the current status of that instance. And then the last point is something to note, which is only one instance of an association is allowed at any particular time. And so this is the scenario in which being able to create multiple associations of the same template is quite useful when you want to have multiple instances of that same workflow definition. Okay, and then this is the last terminology slide, and then we're going to get into the actual workings of the engine. So there's two types of workflow definitions. There are declarative workflows, and those are no-code workflows, meaning it's a pure XML definition of the workflow logic, and that is stored in the content database. And the other are compiled workflows, and these are actual .NET assemblies that are deployed on the server itself, and they have to be deployed as any other SharePoint extension would that is installed on the server with full trust global assembly cache permission. Okay, so now we've introduced the basic concepts of workflow, and now we're going to go through essentially the life cycle of a workflow instance. So looking in here, we see the different entities that I talked about. We have associations, we have the workflows, which is where the instances themselves are created, and then we have the global assembly cache for compiled workflows, and then the table in SharePoint, all user data, where all SharePoint content goes. And then we have two processes that are going to be involved in this picture. One is IIS, which is the web front end, and the other is a workflow timer service, which is you'll see the role that it plays in the workflow for doing some of the long-running processing. So let's start with first the association. So we have an association ID, which is going to relate the associations to the workflows. Every association has a unique identifier. And then workflows themselves are related to SharePoint content. So there's an item ID in the workflow itself, in the workflow instance itself, that relates it back to the item on which that workflow is running. And then our document templates are, for in the case of declarative workflows, they too are stored in the content database as additional SharePoint items. So SharePoint Designer, when the user publishes a workflow, that workflow definition gets saved along with all the other SharePoint content in the SharePoint site. Okay, so let me just do the animation. Okay, let me back up. Okay, so now we're going to go through the scenario of what happens when a user is starting a workflow. And so in this case, what is going to happen is there's a reference where a reference to the workflow gets displayed either in the UI or as a result of an event that will happen. So in this case, what we're going to simulate is a user manually starting a workflow. So I'm going to pick the association that I'm going to run and then click the start operation. And as I mentioned, what you actually execute is the association, not the definition. So in this case, we're going to pick the approval template, and we're going to browse through all of the available associations and then execute one of those. So in this case, the approval is that the approval template has an association called the spec approval, because we're approving, say, a document library that has specifications in it. And so it can be started either manually or as a result of additional events. So when we create the association, I can say, run this workflow definition when a new spec is created or when a spec is changed. And when that association gets created and I've selected the different trigger events, SharePoint will install event receivers in that document library so that when the event happens, it knows it can go ahead and trigger the instance to be created. And that association can refer to either a SharePoint list or a content type or a SharePoint site. And one thing just about terminology is in any SharePoint presentation, you often see the words web and site used interchangeably. And for those of you who are familiar with SharePoint, with the SharePoint object model, you'll know that that's because in the object model, a SharePoint site uses the term SP web. And so that's why in here, when you see web, that refers to a SharePoint site. Okay, so now we've created the association, event receivers have been registered, and now we're gonna start the workflow. So a user is gonna go ahead and do an event that is gonna trigger this workflow. And SharePoint is going to retrieve the association, and it's going to send the request to the workflow host. And ultimately, the way that an instance comes into being is through this internal, through this SharePoint API, which is actually part of the public API surface of SharePoint, called SP Workflow Manager, and that has a method called Start Workflow, and that's what actually creates the instance. And so, because the approval template is a declarative workflow, when workflow, the workflow host is going to go into the content database and retrieve the workflow definition, which contains the XAML, which is the XML markup language that defines the workflow logic. It's going to go ahead and also bring some additional metadata, which is the workflow config, as well as some rules, which are other parts of the workflow definition. The workflow engine has a rules, has an expression evaluation engine, and those are actually stored in a separate file. So, but these are all the declarative definitions of the workflow. All of those will be brought into the workflow engine. The workflow engine will load those, and it'll go ahead and compile, create an executable version of that workflow definition. For code workflows, we don't need to go through that compilation step because there's already a compiled version of the workflow definition, which is stored in the assembly, the global assembly cache. And so in that case, the workflow itself just, the workflow class just gets created and loaded in memory. Okay, and then here's a side note in that there is some, for declarative workflows, we do provide a filtering mechanism that lets system administrators control which .NET types the workflow itself can reference. And this is called the authorized types list. So as part of the compilation step, there's a filtering that will happen and a validation that ensures that you cannot load workflow types that are not defined in that list. Okay, now we have an instance that's created, but it hasn't done anything. And so it just exists in the workflows table. And then the engine is going to essentially schedule an initiating input into the workflow, which is what this on workflow activated event means. And so when you go through and look at information on how to write SharePoint workflows, you'll see that every SharePoint workflow always begins with an activity, which is a shape in the workflow, called on workflow activated. And what that shape does is it's essentially waiting for an event that's going to cause the program to resume. So think of it as the equivalent of main for workflow. Right? It's a thing that's going to pass into the workflow all the context for SharePoint. And the way that that gets scheduled is that there's an actual work item in the work queue that tells the workflow to execute that event on workflow activated. So that event then gets delivered into the instance, and the instance is up and running, and it can go and from that point on execute the program logic. And then when the workflow now needs to do some I/O operation with the rest of SharePoint, it's going to go through a mechanism called external data exchange services, which is an abstraction that lets SharePoint do things like create list items, create tasks, and it's also an extension point on the server. There's an API for how developers can use the SharePoint platform to write additional external data exchange services providers. Okay, and then through that interface, now the workflow is going to execute, and it's at the point where it needs to do some, wants to write back some information for SharePoint. For example, in the case of approval, as part of the input, it received a list of who the approvers are, and now it needs to go and create some tasks for the different approvers that have been that were listed when the workflow got initiated. And so now it's going to go ahead and do some I/O. It's going to write some tasks, and it's going to do that through that external data exchange services interface. There's a service called iTask service. And it goes ahead and creates some tasks. It might also, set some expiration for those tasks. So I can create a task and it says, this task must be acted upon in 3 days or else it needs to be escalated. So if I want to set a due date, it's going to go ahead and write some events in its queue saying to the engine to wake up the workflow again in 3 days, and then it's going to batch the results down into the content database. Go ahead. When somebody requests, could you repeat the scenario? So the question is, when somebody downloads a document from SharePoint, does that trigger this mechanism? And the answer is no. This mechanism gets triggered in a couple of different ways. You actually have to create a workflow either with SharePoint Designer or use one of the built-in workflows. And a user will typically, you have to create an association and you have to set the triggering conditions that will cause the workflow to be created. Through the UI, we have a mechanism where you can create a workflow. Well, it's an experience similar to what you see in Outlook, where you can create sort of a quick workflow that acts on a list. But the general mechanism is always you create a workflow and you have to explicitly associate it before it's available to run. There's no sort of internally, it gets used by some other features in SharePoint will build on this. So for instance, ECM will use this infrastructure to build publishing approvals. But generally, things like downloading a document do not use this infrastructure. So it's a case-by-case basis. Okay, so now that the workflow completed its I/O, it's going to go ahead and it doesn't have any more work available for it to do, and so it's going to go ahead and release resources back to the server, and the workflow state, the instance state itself, is going to get written to the database. So it gets written to the workflows table, and then at that point, the workflow is gone from memory. So now time passes, and remember, in this case, the workflow had created some tasks, and we also had set a due date of 3 days on the on the task that it created. So now we're going to resume that running workflow. So the user is going to go ahead and do something to the workflow, such as mark a task as completed. And so in this case, there's an update that happens to the task list, which causes the event receiver that was created on the task list to fire. And then that event receiver is going to go to the workflow host, and it has correlation information about the task that relates it back to the workflow instance. And so so we can see that in the work items table, there's a new work item that said that there's a task change. And so that the workflow host is going to it's going to match which instance of the workflow is waiting for that event, and it's going to bring that workflow instance back in memory and deliver that event to the right instance. And this is one of the main reasons why developers use workflow, which is the power of this correlation engine that workflow has, that you can take events that happen over a very long period of time and through pretty simple basic correlation mechanisms ensure that the event gets delivered to the right instance of the program. Okay, and now after the event is processed, the workflow can go back and be persisted to disk. And so now we're, now that the one task got updated, but there were other tasks that were written in the in the system, and now more time passes, and we get into the other side of the diagram, which was the workflow timer service. So the workflow timer service, the role of it is for dealing with delay events in the workflow and also as a general background processing engine for workflow. So when whenever the workflows have a lot of, there's a lot of work that's been queued, it's the workflow timer service that will process all of the events. And so essentially the expiration events, the delay events, and throttled operations. So so if a lot of tasks were to get completed all at the same time, what the workflow host will do is rather than process those in line, what it'll actually do is it'll queue those in the works in the work item table for subsequent processing by the workflow timer service. And there's a configurable setting that tells the workflow timer service how many events to process at any given point. And so it'll process those in batches whenever the workflow timer kicks in. And these are all configurable values. So you can configure the interval at which the workflow timer service runs, or you can configure the batch size as well. Okay, so let's look at how that timer service does its job. And it's gonna go ahead and run periodically. It looks in the work items table. And it sees that there's an event to process, a delay event. So it's going to go ahead and retrieve that. All right, so this animation is just showing that it's retrying. It's a polling timer. And now it's reached the expiration time of that task. It's going to go ahead and bring that and then call the workflow host to process that event. And then the workflow host is going to bring the instance from the workflows table. It's going to go ahead and deliver the event to the instance, and then do its normal persistence once the event has been processed. Okay, so I think that was kind of a pretty high level view of the core architecture of the workflow. So now we're going to go through and talk about how you actually provide the input into the workflow and how you can use it to control it. So was that any questions before we move on about just the general mechanics of events? Essentially what we've reviewed is how workflows themselves are these running program instances and how everything that happens inside of workflow is as a result of an event. And we're going to see how we use those basic building blocks of workflow being event-driven, and its sole interaction, the only interaction of the workflow definition itself, is through work that gets scheduled into the work item table as a result of operations that happen on other SharePoint content. Those are important points because as you'll see, many of the questions that come up in terms of how you actually control workflow, ultimately, the answer can be found in terms of how workflows themselves get input. Okay, so the first interaction that a user will have with workflow is through a workflow form, because this is how you actually provide input into the workflow for when it gets created or when you want to advance the workflow. We have four types of forms. The first one is the association form. Remember, I said that we associate a workflow definition with a list. And the association form is a form that that provides some default parameters into the workflow for when the instance gets created. So an example of that might be a list of approvers. And as a design point, the workflow forms are specific to each workflow. So in other words, the only thing that the engine knows is that there's an initiation form URI that is part of the workflow definition, and it's up to the workflow to define what input the form will capture. So the association form defines sort of the base set of values, or it's an opportunity for the workflow to provide some UI at association time. That's probably a better way of saying it. And in the initiation form works in very much the same way, except that that happens when a workflow is being created manually. So if I say in the UI to start a workflow manually, then that's an opportunity. The initiation form is an opportunity for the workflow to provide a prompt for additional input. These things are used by workflows, for instance, as I was saying, to do things like capture a list of approvers or provide expiration periods for tasks and so forth. Workflow tasks can also have their own forms, and then there's also something called a modification form for some advanced scenarios. An advanced scenario of a modification form would be changing the list of approvers of a running workflow instance. And out of those four forms, the task form is actually associated with the task content type. So tasks themselves are just SharePoint content types, and the task form is just using the SharePoint content type infrastructure, which can have a form associated with a content type. The task form is just a form associated with the task content type. Everything else is associated with the workflow template. So a key principle is the fact that the workflow engine itself doesn't know anything about what the form is actually doing. The form is considered part of the workflow template, and the information that the form wants to pass to the workflow template is something that both of those have to be designed simultaneously. The workflow engine is just a pass-through of that information of the form to the workflow definition itself, and it doesn't do any. The engine itself doesn't do any interpretation of that data. The only thing that the engine does know is the fact that there are specific form URIs that are defined along with the workflow definition, and then above that, we use the forms technology in SharePoint to provide two solutions from forms. One is based on ASPX, which is available in SharePoint Server and also in SharePoint Foundation, and the other is InfoPath, which is available in SharePoint Server. And then another observation about when using InfoPath forms is that when a client is interacting with SharePoint and it wants to display a form, it can do two things. In the case where the client has InfoPath, it can host the form download the form and use InfoPath's hosting architecture to host the form in the client. Or it can also use the fact that this is web technology and launch a browser to display the form. So if you have a client that knows how to host the XSN form definition, then that can be done through local processing. Or it can be done in sort of a passive mode of just loading a browser. Okay, so what this is showing you, this is just showing an example of a definition of a workflow definition, and it shows the relationship of the form URLs and the fact that, as you can see here, look at the initiation form is pointing to an InfoPath hosting layer, and then that InfoPath hosting layer knows how to interpret this data that points it to the form URI. This is how the bootstrapping works. And then InfoPath itself has an architecture that allows InfoPath to, through data adapters, it can submit form to its hosting layer. And in the case of the client, there's a client hosting layer that calls the workflow web service. And in the case of the server hosting layer calls the SharePoint OM directly. And so if it's starting a workflow, that workflow web service ultimately is going to call the runtime to start the workflow. But if it's a task, the update actually happens directly on the task list item. And so so as we see when we get to the scenarios, we'll talk about how you actually use the protocol, the workflow protocol, to do both of these things, to start a workflow as well as update a task on the workflow. So another concept in understanding, if we back up, we look at what does it take to update a task. So one of the design principles of the workflow engine is that tasks are responsible for their own completion. What this means is that a workflow task, which is part of the workflow definition, defines what it means for it to be complete, and that the engine itself has no knowledge about what it means for that task to complete. And so going back to the design principle of the engine delivers events to workflow definitions, the interpretation of that event payload is actually defined by the logic inside of the workflow. And so the engine makes no interpretation of that event data. What we'll see is later on when we look into this further, we'll see what our implementation of the task, of the office task, how it understands it, what it does with its own event data. So we provide a task that we ship as part of SharePoint 2010 called Office Task. And this is an example, if you think about it, as a solution that's been built on top of this core infrastructure. And it has some specific behaviors in its logic that in terms of how it processes its event data. But having said that, a developer using Visual Studio could, out of the same core building blocks that we use, define tasks that have completely different behaviors. And to some extent, purely from the point of view of the workflow web service, you actually don't know what the behavior of that task will be. When you update the task, you're updating you call the web service to update a task. You cannot, from the protocol, introspect for what is the event, what is the input that will cause the task to complete. Because as I said, that information is defined by the workflow definition itself and by the form, the task form. And it's up to those two objects to define the contract between them. The workflow web service, the web service contract, all it really does is it says, I'll take data from here and pass it to there. So it's just acts as a pass-through. So we define this approval activity, which we also call office task, and that in and of itself can be used in the context of a larger workflow. And it has this multi-layer behavior where you can modify the behavior of the logic. So for instance, you can have events that happen when the approval is about to start, when the approval is in progress, and when it ends. And inside of there, you can control the behavior of individual tasks. So a pretty common scenario would be one where you want to say, actually I have it here, where for instance, if you wanted to model the case of if somebody hasn't completed a task by a certain period of time, you want to escalate to a manager. You know, there's a layer when the task is in progress where you could define that behavior, or you can also have a behavior that says that this whole task is approved if 50% of the approvers have signaled that approval. Okay, so in the time that we have remaining, what I'll try to do is I'll try to go through some examples of how to use the workflow protocol to interact with the system. We're going to focus on this protocol primarily, which has these methods. So this is all documented in the protocol documentation. We're going to focus primarily on alter to do, which is how do we update a task in order to advance the workflow, and then also how we start a workflow. And then everything else, the other methods are designed for clients to be able to get some of the relationships in order to be able to find the associations, and be able to, say, for an instance of a document, find out what are the available workflow associations that have been set up. Okay, so in starting a workflow instance, the method takes an item, which is the item to which the workflow has been associated with, and it also takes a template ID. And that template ID is actually, as the term is a little bit of a misnomer. As I said, that you actually don't execute workflow templates, you only execute associations. So even though the name is template ID in the web service, the actual value that it takes is in association, because only associations are what can actually be created. And the third input that it takes is the workflow parameters. And just as I was saying earlier, the parameters themselves are, it's up to each workflow definition to interpret what to do with those workflow parameters. So the protocol doesn't impose any structure on that XML. Any questions about this? Okay, so since this workflow engine doesn't impose any structure, then what are the actual values if you actually were to look at what gets passed in there? Where are those things coming from? Well, it turns out that when SharePoint Designer publishes a workflow, that those workflows that SharePoint Designer creates actually expect a input in a certain format. And again, this is just how SharePoint Designer creates a workflow. But again, there could be somebody, a developer could have deployed a workflow written in Visual Studio in SharePoint that expects something completely different. And to some extent, it's that understanding how to start a workflow is unique to each workflow definition. So when I talk about this, all I'm really referring to is the workflows that have been created by SharePoint Designer. So workflows, SharePoint Designer workflows understand input in two different formats. One is the info path format, which you see there, which in the schema, there's a my field schema that InfoPath uses. And so those workflows know how to interpret parameters in that format. And then also for ASPX-based forms, there's a format in which there's a root object, and then every child of that root, the label is the field name, and then the value is the inner text is the value of the field. And some additional notes that you might find useful as you start writing solutions that want to be able to control workflows. It's worth noting, in terms of how, where SharePoint Designer stores field metadata. This is field metadata that gets used by SharePoint Designer at design time, and it must, has to store it along with the workflow definition for the next time that you open it. But where it's actually saved, it's saved as part of the workflows library that's in the content database. And there's an XML file called wfconfig, which, as we saw earlier, it's part of the additional artifacts that get published along with the workflow definition. That XML file actually contains the design time information that SPD used in order to create the forms that get used at runtime. And then if you're actually using the SharePoint object model, you see that configuration data actually gets promoted inside of these workflow template properties. And in there, you actually see the CAML, the collaboration application markup language that defines those fields. And that can be useful if you want to do some programmatic interpretation of what SharePoint Designer workflows, what inputs they expect. Has anybody actually tried looking at this stuff inside of the workflows? Okay. So the next scenario is now the workflow's running and you want to go ahead and update a task in order to advance the workflow. And in this case, what you want to do is you actually have to update the ultimately, what happens is that the task list item is updated. And the workflow web service actually provides a callable method that you do that. And one of the things that it takes is it takes the task data, which is the set of values that are going to get updated in the task. And so the question then is, how do you update a task in order to signal that something like approval or rejection? And this gets to the other important principle that I mentioned, which is that tasks are responsible for their own completion. So it's up to the task itself, the task activity, to define how to interpret completion. And so the behavior that I'm describing here is really just how our implementation of the office task makes the determination about outcomes. So if, when using office task, what you actually would do if you wanted to mark that task as completed is you would, we have a status column in the workflow, and you would set that to a text called completed, and you also set the completion percent to 1. And then if you want to also signal an outcome such as approved or rejected, we have there's a hidden task status field in which you set to these two values. To a pound sign means succeeded, or an at sign means rejected. And those behaviors are specific to tasks that were created by Office Task. But tasks that were created through other uses of the workflow engine, through other actions, or that were created directly by the workflow developer, those tasks may not exhibit the same behavior. And so, it's up to you to interpret whether your client understands what the task expects in order to be able to provide the input that you intend. So if you wanted to identify if a specific task was created by Office Task, then you can see that you can inspect the content type and determine what was the source of that task. Okay, and then I'm sure you'll all get the deck, so you can just have here for reference a list of other relevant web services that you might find useful in the context of building solutions or clients that interoperate with the workflow web service. So in particular, there's the East Asia, the Group Approval Web Service Protocol. These were some additional methods that that create that enable some scenarios on top of the core infrastructure that we've talked about. And then there's just general how to interoperate with SharePoint through web services for doing things like updating list items and publishing or reading content from SharePoint. Okay, so I think we're kind of out of time. I know that was a lot of content, but we have some time for some questions. Well, the question is to provide some examples of how enterprises are using workflow. So, as I mentioned earlier, the focus of SharePoint workflow really is around content and human-centric workflows. So the main scenario is around documents, right? So documents have a certain life cycle where they get routed through different individuals. And so you can think of really any process in which documents are routed. That's a very large percentage of the usage. So for example, it could be things like in the public sector, for instance, you could have different municipalities, for instance, have a process around when there's an item that gets tracked. And it has to go through different levels of review and approval. So it could be things like a permit or other municipal documents where you want to actually have a defined process in how they get routed. That's one scenario where, for instance, one case study of using SharePoint workflow. Another one is where you want to make sure that you have a consistent process that is repeatable. So when you're doing publishing and you want to follow very well-defined processes with a certain level, with a certain SLA that the content gets processed in a timely manner, in a consistent way, and that any exceptions to that, will get flagged. That's another very common scenario. Other scenarios are being able to use this infrastructure as a rapid application development infrastructure because of the power of workflow is that it makes writing these long-running, event-driven applications, things that happen in human scale, makes it easy to automate those processes through the power of having a declarative programming language, a long-running, event-driven infrastructure that handles all the hard problems around correlation, persistence, and scale for you. So, there's lots of different scenarios. Does that give you a sense for the kinds of solutions? So the question is, from an end user perspective, how do you create workflows?
State diagram user workflows to do exactly
what you want. Yeah, so you can to create state diagram workflows. There's actually quite a few different tools for creating workflows. One is the SharePoint Designer, which uses a rule-based, textual-based definition language for workflows. You can also use Visio as a starting point for drawing your workflow in a graphical way. And this is you can start it in a visual way and then import that into SharePoint Designer. But then, if you actually wanted to model the workflow as a state machine, then in that case, what you use is Visual Studio, and that's where you create a compiled workflow and you can model your workflow as a state machine. All of those are in a typical workflow project. Could use either one of those solutions in order to define the workflow process.
So let's say that you use the config to complete a task, and the task
So the question is, if you're completing a task, but then that doesn't complete the workflow,
or
doesn't progress the workflow, what could that be a symptom of? So I guess the first thing that I would do if I were diagnosing a situation like that is I would just make sure that the event itself was delivered to the activity, to the task activity itself. And so so if we go back to the initial, to the conceptual diagram, the event is going to be written in a queue, and then that queue essentially, that event in the queue is going to be delivered to the workflow instance. So the first thing that you need to make sure that happens is that the correlation of that event to the instance has actually been set up correctly. And normally it's not a common source of errors, but it just means that when the event itself, and certainly through SharePoint Designer, that's usually not a common case. But if you're writing your workflow in Visual Studio, it's possible that your correlation information could have gotten sort of not been set properly, where you're missing correlation tokens. Yeah, that should be the same. So both completing the test through the UI and through the web service ultimately goes through the same. At the lowest level, what happens is that the task list item will get updated, and then an event will fire, and then that event queues the event in the queue. So both the web service as well as the UI ultimately, the form loaded in the UI or the form in the client calling the web service will update that list item. So I would check to make sure that what is being written in the task list item is what the task activity expects. And if the workflow received the event, then that's probably the next thing that I would do. Just make sure that it's the expected values of the task.
Okay, thanks.